Blog Talk Radio.
Denise Griffiths is your partner in success. Tune in each Friday as virtual assistants, industry expert, web developer, and online entrepreneur Denise Griffiths interviews industry experts from one end of the internet to the other. These expert entrepreneurs freely share their business building knowledge and provide practical guidance that will show you how to build and grow your own very successful business, be it online or traditional brick and mortar. Now, ladies and gentlemen, your partner in success, Denise Griffiths.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio. This week, I welcome Rudy Wilson Galdonic. Hailed as the Irma Bomback for the 21st century, Rudy is a menopausal mom with an attitude, and you'll see later why I'm chuckling. And she's a Tadshia Bionic. She is a lifelong heart patient with over $40,000 worth of equipment embedded in her chest. Apparently, installation costs extra. Rudy is the author of Inspirational Stories and Chicken Soup for the Soul, Tea Time Stories for Women, Stories of God's Abundance, and Teens Can Bounce Back, as well as numerous articles. She's a contributor to Improving Systems of Care, A Patient's Perspective, and in 2010, won honorable mention in the Penn Soul Making Contest for Literary Nonfiction. Rudy is also the author of Take Heart, which chronicles her experiences with heart surgeries, raising a family, and experiencing widowhood at a very early age. Rudy manages to take on all of these experiences and give a humorous and very soulful insight into dealing with life's challenges. So good morning, Rudy, and welcome to your Partner in Success Radio.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Oh, listen, you have a really great story. And it's an interesting story. It's an inspiring story. And I would love for you to share that with our audience. As I told you earlier, you have one of those stories that kind of lets people know that you don't have to kind of pigeonhole yourself into a 9-to-5 job, even if one is available these days. You can work to your passion. You should work to your passion. And you should, you know, share your life experiences. So tell us about yourself.
Well, your point that you just made, I absolutely agree with it. I think we're all gifted with certain things. And unfortunately, I think sometimes it starts as early as high school when, you know, we anticipate getting our first job and we look to get a job. And we don't try to apply the things that, you know, we're passionate about, the things that make us happy, the things that we might think we are good at. And then that, unfortunately, many times will just evolve. It even evolves into any higher education that we pursue, and then, of course, a career. When I first graduated college, I went to work for a bank. It was a disaster because I'm just not the banker type.
I would think that would be stupefyingly dull, but that's just me.
Oh, you got that right. But I ended up working in the human resources department, which, again, I had the opportunity to leave that bank and realized it was not banking that I was passionate about, but working in human resources, you know, with individuals who were also, you know, interesting and dynamic and unique and, you know, sometimes would make you crazy. That part of it I liked. So, again, I took the opportunity to leave one company and begin to point myself in a direction that I was much more gifted at.
Well, and I think that that's where I really want to go with this discussion that we're having today because, you know, given what's going on in America right now, all over the world actually, getting a job out of high school, staying in that job for 40 years, getting your pension or whatever was set up for you along the way, it's just not reality anymore. So it really is time, I think, for people to just dig in and say, you know, I've only got this one life that I'm aware of.
Yeah.
Why not make it the best life that it can possibly be for me and the people around me and those within my sphere of influence, if you will? And that's really what I wanted to talk with you about today. How do you make that journey, particularly with your health issues? How do you make that journey from working a job, working in a bank, which, you know, is a good job if that's what you're cut out to do?
Sure.
But how do you make that transition from saying, you know, this is not my passion. I don't really feel like I'm doing what God meant for me to do, what I mean for me to do. how do you break out of that, and how do you make that step, as you put it, that leap into faith? How do you do this, and what advice do you give people who are looking at unemployment and looking at, oh, my God, there's no job for me now, what do I do? You know, what do you tell people?
Well, I think in particular in today's economy, and my heart goes out to people, you know, who have been laid off or who have lost their job for a variety of reasons. It is difficult. This is a very unique time. It is extremely difficult, and I absolutely really feel for the people who are struggling. If I were in the situation, I think one of the things you need to do is surround yourself with people that are willing to be an encouragement to you, to be a safe place to fall, and then maybe identify ways that you can even volunteer initially to get yourself out there and keep yourself moving. But don't volunteer in something, you know, that would be a chore, that would be a challenge for you. Try and identify some place where you could volunteer to actually make the connections that would then translate into the potential for jobs. The bulk of people get jobs through relationships. You know, all the online resumes and, you know, the statistics were just mind-boggling. When I worked in human resources, after I left the bank in human resources, I went to work, and again, I quickly realized that it was not banking that I was passionate about. So I took a position in human resources at a liberal arts university, but then had the opportunity 6 months later to be promoted to the medical center campus. So now all of a sudden, this was just through coincidence, I began to realize I'm a lifelong heart patient. I was diagnosed with a heart defect at the age of 5. And so I had always had living, you know, with a chronic health condition all of my life. It clearly defined who I was to many, in many ways. And so now I was doing human resources at a medical university, which was 24/7 hour operation. You had everyone from the most brilliant minds to people who were uneducated, you know, who may have had the positions of housekeeping or whatever. There was lots of variety in the jobs. And so I began to realize, okay, now I'm coupling two things that I can be passionate about. And it was a great time working in that career. So
you think a lot of it could just simply be self-awareness, you know, be aware of what it is that you are passionate about, where you can, you know, be of service and
right,
you know, help other people and not necessarily take that $10 an hour job just to get by. I mean, take
right,
it if you need to.
You may need to do that. I think our lives are compartmentalized, and you may be in a period of time where right now I need to have some income to put food on the table. But you still need to have that opportunity to plan and anticipate, you know, where you would, you know, find the most joy. I mean, I think people that, you know, if they make the wise decisions, they can literally, when I was in the right job in the right place, I can't wait to get up and get out of bed in the morning, because it's not work. It's, you know, I'm living my passion. And I think it's possible, but I think you have to make a lot of tough decisions, and you have to be honest with yourself in the journey along that way.
Right. And I'm not saying don't go mow grass. I'm not saying go clean houses if that's what you need to do.
Right.
But you can find joy in cleaning houses. I actually like to clean houses. I'm one of those.
Well, then I should have you come to my place. That's one thing that does not rate real high in my home.
Straighteners, so I do it. You know, I need a very tidy environment.
Oh, so you need it. Okay. All right. Well, I definitely need it.
I must have a tidy environment or I completely lose focus. But that's just part of, I think, being an A-type personality. I think it's a characteristic. It could be a flaw. I'm not sure. But anyway, I know that one of the things that you and I have talked about is just how you step out on your path. I mean, how you kind of take that leap of faith. And let's face it, that's what it is. Because sometimes your biggest arguments are with yourself. Oh, you know, I've got to get the money in the bank. I've got to have a job. I've got to do this. How do you make that leap of faith and say, I'm not happy doing this? How do I do something that I'm happy doing?
Well, I think one of the things that is so unfortunate in our culture is that we put so much emphasis and so much focus on the material possessions of life.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of people are saying to themselves, you know, I can't survive because I can't survive with that, you know, two-story colonial with the attached three-car garage kind of thing. Or, you know, and I think that places a tremendously heavy burden on people to try and either maintain or potentially take on the material possessions in life that we really are not in a position to be able to afford comfortably.
Mm-hmm.
I think it starts there, too. You know, if, again, I have not lost my job, so I really would be limited in the expertise that I could offer in that area. But I do know that 5 years ago, my husband and I decided, because our kids had just left the house, we decided to downsize. Or actually, I decided to downsize, and my husband kept saying, I love the three-car garage. And I'm like, you know what, it's not necessary. And my passion was historic homes, so I ended up buying a house that was much smaller. It had been built in 1877, and it was low enough in price that, you know, we could afford that plus afford a renovation. And now I have this small historic house a block and a half from down this little historic village downtown, and I love it. I have never had so much comfort. And I also think the environment is significantly different. I have a very eclectic neighborhood that I live in, where everyone is from, you know, senior citizens who are retired, people who work in the trades. We have a number of teachers and, you know, a variety of different people. In my last neighborhood, everyone was either a physician or an attorney or a business owner. And the thing was, after I lived in that house for 10 years, if you would have told me my life depended on it, I could not have told you what five of my closest neighbors even looked
mm-hmm.
like.
Right.
Because everyone used the, you know, the garage door opener. They would pull into their car, into their garage. They, you know, lower the door. They had professional landscapers that maintained their yards. And people didn't have relationships because they were so busy, you know, with their work. And now it's like, you know, our neighborhood is family. It's really family.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that that's, you know, we all go through stages in our life. The neighborhood you just described is actually how I live. I couldn't tell you who my neighbors are. I don't even recognize their cars. And I live in a pretty small little town. It's a village, actually.
Mm-hmm.
But the neighborhood that I live in is we drive in, we park our cars, we don't come out. You know, we have yard crews that take care of everything. So I know exactly what you're talking about. At this stage in my life, I'm perfectly comfortable with that. Now, I have been at stages in my life where that would have just, I would have been going, oh, how snotty. Right now, it suits me.
Right, right.
You know, 5 years down the road, I may be looking for, you know, a seaside village where I can stroll down the street and you know, get a croissant or something. So I think life does definitely change.
Yes.
But again, how do you, there's sea changes. They really are. I mean, how do you know that it's time to make these changes? How do you just say, you know, this is not working anymore, it's maybe part of my journey, now what do I do?
Well, I think, again, I think the decisions that we make, the primary advice that I would give to people is the bulk of who we are, we're created to be relationship-oriented.
Right.
And so if, you know, and even, I mean, I function as a writer, and so I spend a lot of time, you know, in my home office writing, and it's not something where, you know, I am connecting with people. But
mm-hmm.
yet, I also recognize the value of having maybe not a huge number of relationships, but I have some very significant relationships that I know I can go to that person and just maybe pick their brain. And I felt, again, 5 years ago that it almost made me sad, the fact that I was in this home that, you know, that we weren't using to its full capacity.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the family that bought from us, because we were in a time when actually houses were selling relatively easily. And right. And there was a young family. So again, like you said, there's stages in life, and so this
right.
house was
yeah.
perfect for them. Now where I am, it's perfect for me. But I think we have to be willing to give ourselves permission to identify the areas where maybe we're not happy, we have that sense of sadness or a sense of burden, and ask ourselves, why is that? And what is it about my circumstances or my life that I'm able to change?
Mm-hmm. Well, one of the things that I'm noticing, I think we're all noticing this right now, just too many people feel like they don't have the opportunity to make choices. Things are happening fast and furious, and they're not good, a lot of them. And, they're losing their homes. Their bank accounts have been just decimated, or, their job. I was listening to, who is the financial guy on radio? Ball guy. Can't remember his name right now, but I was listening to him in my car. And he's very, very good. He gives very common sense, information. And he was talking to a gentleman who, and I really found this story heartbreaking. He and his wife lost their jobs a week apart.
Wow.
A week apart. And, that's a body blow. And the advice he gave the gentleman was just stand back, take a breath. You're actually in shock and you're grieving and you don't even know it yet. Don't make any big decisions right now, which I
Absolutely.
Thought was excellent. Ramsey, Dave Ramsey.
Dave Ramsey, right.
Yeah, I love Dave Ramsey. Couldn't remember his name for the life of me. But I thought that was some very good common sense advice. He said, could circle back around in 3 months and see where you're at. Opportunities may very well present themselves.
And I also thought
that was brilliant.
I also think some of that common sense advice we've gotten away from because I have two children now who are in their mid-20s, and I had a conversation with my son just 2 days ago, and he would love to buy a house. And, it's to his advantage now because he's not trying to sell a house. He's living in an apartment, and he would love to stop paying rent. But as we began to talk, I said, before you jump into that, as nice and as fun as and exciting as that sounds, you can't do it until you have all of your reserves in place.
Mm-hmm.
And so, again, I think we have gotten to this mentality of, I want that, give me that. And so that's how a lot of us have, purchased outside
right.
of our, ability to pay for things. And I think Dave Ramsey, Susie Orman is also an excellent
mm-hmm.
financial person to give very basic, very sound advice. And I was very fortunate when I graduated college, I married, the guy I dated for 5 years, and he was very conservative and very, very, very conservative, I guess is the best way, where we never purchased a home that was, more than we could afford. We always had
mm-hmm.
A situation with, with reserves just in case something happened. And then when he was 42, one morning he woke up with a lump on his neck. He had been an athlete. He had been a health nut. We, worked out every week. He was a great tennis player, fabulous dad, an amazing husband. And he wakes up one morning with a lump on his neck, and then 13 months later, I'm widowed.
Mm.
And so those things do happen. Again, you described how Dave Ramsey made the comment to the listener, you're in mourning. I get that. I know what it means
mm-hmm.
to feel, a sense of being in mourning because your world has been ripped out from under you.
Right, and nothing looks right to you.
Right.
Nothing looks the same as it did the day before. It's a very different world that you're living in now.
Right.
And this, people experience that when they lose a good friend, when they lose a mate, when they lose a child, when they lose a pet. I mean, I have known people who just spiraled a little bit out of control and they lost a very loved pet. Lose your home, lose your job. Oh, my God. Those are body blows.
Yes, absolutely.
So,
And so, but again, if we try and take baby steps and make the right decisions based on the information, that we have gleaned, even if it means that we have to, do without, even
mm-hmm.
if it means we don't buy that, you know, $40,000, $50,000, or $30,000 car. We may even have to, you know, drive something that, you know, is less significant. We live in a, you know, in a home that is not as plush as we, you know, would like. If we create a solid foundation, then when those really, really tough times happen, and they happen. I mean, you know, you can make all the wise decisions in the world, and the tough stuff happens. Mm-hmm. But then at least if you've made, you know, more realistic decisions up to that point, you may not have everything ripped out from under you. Because I've met women who've been widowed, and there was, you know, nothing in place for them to move forward. And you know, then you suffer from a series of losses, not only the loss of a spouse or, you know, someone close to you.
Mm-hmm. Well, and not only that, but it seems to me like one loss often propagates another loss. It just seems to how that, you know, happens, and I'm not sure how that happens. Are you there?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Okay, it seemed like I lost you there from when we went kind of silent. I know that one of the things that I wanted to talk with you about, you are a speaker, and this is where I really wanted to go with this, because you've done some remarkable things in your life with, you know, you've had issues. I mean, you've had, you know, some kind of life-altering things happen to you. You lost your husband. You are a lifelong heart patient. You've got a remarkable story, and really that's what I wanted you to share today, is just you can take, what was it, Irma Bombeck said, life is a bowl of cherries.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I love Irma Bombeck.
Yeah.
She is so funny. I actually have a bunch of her books in paperback that I picked up at garage sales, and I'll pull one out just every now and then, because I think she was just, she was really hilarious, and you are too. One of the things that I want, in fact, you're known as the Irma Bombeck of us now, so there you go. I knew there was a reason I was going there. How do you do the things that you do? Is it a matter of faith, or do you just know that you're walking in your own footsteps? How do you do it?
Well, I think the two components that have helped me along have been the source of my foundation is first of all, I came to the realization early on that life's not fair. And I think, you know, it's not. I mean, I was diagnosed with a hole in my heart back when I went for my kindergarten exam. You know, my family had promised me, well, it's just a necessary thing you have to go through, and kindergarten is so much fun. Well, then all of a sudden they find out I'm born with a hole in my heart, and everything changes for me. And then in sixth grade, I correctly guessed the number of Cheerios in the jar at the PTA fun fair, my big win in my life. And they present me with a canned ham. And I'm like looking at this thing. And the year before, the grand prize had been a brand new invention, which was a transistor radio. And I'm looking at this thing and I'm saying, why did I win a canned ham? You know, who
really
thinks a little kid wants a canned ham? So that was my first clue that life is not fair. And many things in my childhood I couldn't do because of my birth defect. However, at the same time, I was very fortunate in that open-heart surgery, back when I was diagnosed, consisted of a milk pump from a dairy farm and beer hose from a brewery, and little children were hooked up to their parents for their only source of oxygen, if you can
you
believe.
You are kidding me.
I did not know that. Yes, there were several other, there were pioneering physicians in several different hospitals around the country, but at the University of Minnesota, there was a doctor named Dr. C. Walton Lillehigh, and he used a milk pump and beer hose to hook children up to their parents, and he operated on 45 children that way, because up to that point, every heart-lung machine that they had tried to develop had killed its patients, so it was like really frowned upon to use. And so my diagnosis, basically my parents were told, just don't let her do anything. So I spent my childhood feeling like I was perfectly normal, but having to live a very sedentary childhood.
Mm.
And I think, I learned very early on, I guess. Yeah, I learned very early on that life's not fair. But then I also learned that humor is mandatory, and I think that also came from my childhood. I think I didn't particularly grow up in a funny family, you know, but yet I would be lifted up through humor. I mean, even some of the old comedians and things, to the point, I remember probably my favorite gift as a child was a book of jokes, you know, and now I don't own the book anymore. It was long thrown in the trash, but it was probably my favorite gift ever. And I just recited those jokes over and over again. I'm sure they were all, you know, why did the chicken cross the road kind of jokes. And I think by the end of like 3 hours, my parents were ready to kill me. But it gave me a clue as to what was important to me. Mm-hmm. And then the third thing was faith. And that is something that evolved over time, because when I was a little kid, I grew up in a church that was very joyless. There was just absolutely no joy. It was kind of like one of these Pollyanna things where a pastor would get up every week and scream messages of doom and gloom. But yet I began to, you know, I had that inkling, and then it wasn't until I became an adult when I realized, well, wait a minute, if the Bible says we're supposed to be created in God's image, and there is humor out there. I mean, there's poor-tasting humor, I believe, but you do have to have a perspective to know something is funny. And you learn that when you travel to foreign countries, because you can say something that's hysterical to an English-speaking American, and you try to translate that into a foreign language, and they just stare at you like, you know, okay, so what's the point? You know? So there has to be a perspective.
I know. I live in the Deep South, and what is hilariously funny to us, Yankees don't get.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, it can cross state lines. I mean, something just, you know, we have speech patterns down here that are really hilarious, but you have to understand them. And if you don't understand them, they can sound ignorant as all get out. But oh my God, they're funny. But you have to understand what's being said. So yeah, I get that.
Yeah, so when I began to realize that if we're supposed to be created in God's image and there is humor out there, then God had to be funny first, or we wouldn't get it. And so that really impacted my faith journey. And so those three things have really defined the journey that I have, you know, had in life. And I think that adds to, you know, to my life in, you know, from a professional perspective, because I basically took a job when I graduated college and then realized, you know, that if this is the rest of my life, this is going to be torture. And I was had the opportunity many times to do things that were, you know, really not jobs. They were my passion. So,
well, when did you basically just say, I'm not going to have a job anymore? It's really not what I want to do. It's really not how I best serve myself or serve my community or, you know, serve anybody at all. When did you kind of make that decision and then the transition into being an entrepreneur and a speaker and an author? Did you just kind of wake up one day and go, I'm going to do this? Or was it a process by where you just took all of those lessons in life and just put them into play?
I think in the early stages, I had the opportunity, and I consider this very fortunate. My husband was transferred and promoted a lot of times during the early years of our marriage. And each time I came along as the wife and was, you know, needed to resign from where I worked. And so each time I asked myself, okay, what was it about that job I really liked? And what was it about that job I did not like? And so I sort of gave myself a promotion in a way, because I was very honest with myself. When I went to work for that liberal arts university and then the medical center campus, the next time I was looking for a job, again, it was because of a move on my husband's part. But it was a state civil service system. And so that civil service system created a lot of red tape. So then I said to myself, I love the human resources. I love the hospital environment. But I don't like the red tape of the civil service system. So then I took what I had experienced. I took my background. And then I started identifying, okay, this is the kind of work I'm going to look for. And I took a position in human resources in a hospital, community hospital. And so, again, I was fine-tuning where my passions and my gifts were. And then after that, I was able to, again, move again. And I decided, okay, I like the community hospital. You know, it was okay. I love the hospital. I love the medical environment. I love the human resources. But then I said, you know what? I want the big city hospital. I want the medical center instead of the community hospital that, you know, deals more with, you know, broken legs and, you know, mm-hmm. and things like that. So, so each time we moved, I was able to fine-tune it. Then after I had kids, I was interested in going to work, and I ended up purchasing a travel agency. And that was really my first opportunity to – this was back in the days when travel agencies – they weren't easy to make money in, but it was not like what today's, you know, market is. It's a very mm-hmm. different environment for people in the travel business. And I'm not saying that you can't succeed in travel, but you have to have a niche. And mm-hmm. So when I realized, okay, my passion, if I wanted to work in travel, again, I knew, you know, I liked the being the entrepreneur, and I also grew up bilingual, so then I thought, okay, I've, you know, been to Europe a number of times and, you know, love to travel, and so again, I identified the things that were important to me. When my husband and I were first looking, you know, for us to buy a business, for me to run, he was looking at Jiffy Lube. And he was saying, you know, there's good profit margin in Jiffy Lube. And I remember looking at him and saying, do you think for 1 minute I will get out of bed in the morning to run a Jiffy Lube? And then he said, well, what is it that you like? And I said, well, I love to travel. I'm bilingual. And so then all of a sudden, you know, we made a beeline for researching and finding a travel agency.
Right. So, at that moment, I would have looked at my husband and said, have we met?
Yeah, exactly.
Hi. I mean,
he was looking at profit margin. Yeah, and it's like profit margin.
That's a man
is
thing.
Not, yeah, exactly. I said profit margin is not going to get me out of bed in the morning. I'm sorry.
No.
So
I'm sorry. I'm giggling, but I'm picturing you in a Jiffy Lube cap. I just.
Well, I mean, I was
in
so
bed
stupid.
Because you wouldn't have gotten out of bed. So.
I was so
I'm
stupid
sorry,
in
that's
college.
So funny.
I was engaged to a guy named Bill Wilson, and there was Wilson Trucking Company. It was some kind of trucking, big 18-wheelers. So I go for a job interview at the Wilson Trucking Company because I thought it would be so cute with the last name of Wilson working for Wilson. And the guy looked at me when I showed up for the interview, and he said, you've got to be kidding. Like, that was the end of the interview. So, again, sometimes we just go for what, you know, what is simple and what's available, but if we take
right.
that time to ask ourselves, you know, what gets our blood flowing? What is it that we do that where time flies? You know, what is it that we do that really gets our blood pumping? Then that's usually a clue. That's
yeah.
really a clue. And that's the kind of thing that I think people need to ask themselves. Am I doing something that, you know, that really thrills me? And again, with today's market, maybe it's not the time to resign from a position, but maybe you can start making decisions slowly, you know, that will at least head you in that right direction.
Right, right. And, you know, here's the thing, too, and I know you've experienced this. Every entrepreneur, author, speaker, entrepreneur that I have ever come into contact with, we all have the same kind of characteristic, and that is that whatever it is that we're doing, even if it's a job that we really don't much like and we're not probably a good fit, we give it our best. We do, because
yeah.
that's just who we are. But we also have the, I guess, the gumption, if you want to call it that, to go home at night and say, you know, I really hate my job. I mean, I have the last job I ever had, I still cringe when I think about it. I hated it so bad, but
right.
I was excellent at it. Because I was not going to let myself out, you know, down. And I wasn't, my employer gave me a job. He paid me well. He deserved the best I had. I mean, I went home miserable every day. I mean, miserable.
Yeah.
But I did, I left behind a good body of work when I walked out that door. But it also gave me the courage and the guts to say,
yeah.
I am never going to work like this again. I don't want to drag myself out of bed, go to work, look around me and go, oh, my God. Gosh, what am I doing here? And then just have to force myself to give the best possible work I can give all day.
Right.
I mean, I really did have to force myself. I didn't enjoy the work. I didn't enjoy the people. I really hated it.
Yeah.
So
and see,
when I walked out for good, and I skipped across the parking lot, I opened my car door, I jumped in, and I was bouncing up and down in my car seat because I knew I was never going to put myself in that position again, and
right.
I never have. So there's something to be said for giving all you've got, whether you're a Walmart greeter, whether you're a CEO, whatever it is that you're doing. If it's not your passion, do the best you can do because that opens other doors.
Absolutely. And people will recognize that.
Oh, yeah.
People will absolutely recognize that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So tell me a little bit about, you've got a great story about your son. Tell me about your son, because that story scared me stupid. I have to ask.
Sorry.
That's okay. I have office staff, too.
Yes. When my son was 16 years old, he was beginning his junior year of high school, and he saunters in one evening into the kitchen, and he said, "Mom, I want to hike the Appalachian Trail." And I'm like, "Hello?" You know, I mean, it was ridiculous. And I said, "Absolutely not." Now, a little bit of background, 2 years after my husband passed away, I was remarried, and I remarried a backwoods Minnesotan. And his passion was hiking, backpacking, things like that. So as a guy bonding thing, he had taken my son on a few camping trips. And one of them actually ended up where my husband was poisoned and ended up in the intensive care unit. So my son had those, you know, I mean, not that that particular trip was minor, but he had, you know, little short trips. I think the longest one they ever took together was 4 days. And now he wanted to hike the Appalachian Trail. And he had never spent one night out in the woods alone. So I told him.
He was going to do this on his own.
On his own, all by himself.
Right,
yeah.
Right.
And I said, "Oh, no way, not possible." And so, but then again, because I have a sense, I am so sorry. I don't know what's
That's
happening.
Okay.
This is my in-town neighborhood.
I hear that.
Sorry about that.
I'm waiting for my cats to start running their circuit around the house and screaming at each other just to kind of join in.
So, again, as my source, you know, because of my faith, I basically made this statement off the top of my head. I said, "But if God wants you to hike the trail, then I won't stand in your way." And I know now what I was doing was I was making an attempt to have God be the bad guy. Because I knew, you know, they say God doesn't give you what you can't handle. I knew I couldn't handle that. And so I was basically saying, okay, then, you know, when you try to put this together and it doesn't happen, then all of a sudden I can just, you know, very flippantly say, well, I guess it was just not God's will. And that's where my planning was in the back of my mind. And then later that day, my husband and I, we laid out certain very specific parameters that my son would have to think about. And the first parameter was, you are not dropping out of school to hike the Appalachian Trail. You're a junior in high school, you know, one of your most significant years to get ready to go to college. And so I said, no, you cannot drop out of high school. I said, you would never be able to hike at night. You'd have to take a cell phone and call whenever you could. You know, when we were laying all these things out, and then we calculated for him to hike the Appalachian Trail, he would need to get out of school early, at least 1 month. And that was if he was never ill or never became injured, he'd still need that many days to be able to do this. Because the Appalachian Trail is 2,168 miles.
I know. Isn't that like a 3-month trip or something?
That's
I can't remember, but...
Yeah, it's... It can easily be 3 months, 4 months. I mean, some people take as long as 6 or 7 months even, depending on how quickly they go.
Right.
And so we knew that his summer vacation would not be enough. So we realized that he would have to hike pretty much every vacation during his junior year of school, the scheduled vacations. And then he would have to hike an extra 30 months over the course of the summer. And that's, again, assuming he never got sick and never got injured.
Right.
And so the very first thing my son did was he went to the high school principal, said, "Can I get out a month early?" And the principal said, no way. I mean, I actually showed up at the meeting, and he wouldn't even let us in the office. So I'm thinking, wow, this is perfect. This is great. You know, I'm not the bad guy now. It's the principal. And then the following week, I had the opportunity to speak at a corporate event in town. And as I was being introduced, the man sitting next to me said, oh, that lady in the back corner of the room, she's the new superintendent for your school system in your town. And I knew her name, but I had never seen her in person. So had he not made that comment, I wouldn't have realized that. And so as I'm giving this speech, it was about, I don't know, it was about 25 minutes, I'm thinking in my head, should I introduce myself? No, I'm not going to introduce. Maybe I should say something. So finally, at the end of this luncheon program, everyone clears out, everyone goes home, and it's me and the superintendent left in the room. So I went up to her and I said, oh, by the way, I have this wacko kid in your high school, and he thinks he wants to hike the Appalachian Trail. And the superintendent looked at me and she goes, oh, that's your son. So the principal had already called her up and said, I have this wacko kid who thinks he wants to hike the Appalachian Trail. But then the superintendent says to me, she said, now I know who you are and what your story is. She said, we'll make it happen.
Uh-oh.
And I'm standing there in front of her, and in my head this voice is screaming, no, lady, that's the wrong answer.
Right.
And so she went back to the principal. She said, make sure the teachers are all on board, but we're going to make this happen. And so we went back to each one of my son's teachers, and it was so funny. Everybody thought it was a fabulous idea. And the one teacher who was hard to convince was the health teacher. And
really?
Brad's like, yes. Brad's like, if this isn't going to be healthy for me. You know, she. So then she finally compromised, and she said, well, when you come home, you have to write a paper. So he wrote some kind of a paper on, you know, on actually on nutrition and digestion and, you know, what he learned from living on granola bars and hiking 40 miles a day sometimes.
Wow.
But
how long did
that,
it take him to do this?
He hiked a total of 89 days. He hiked several vacations. He hiked. His very first vacation was Columbus Day weekend. Here in the Northeast, we get Columbus Day weekend, plus they threw in a teacher work day the next day, so that was a four-day hike. And the funny thing was, he thought initially he didn't need a map, and so he just jumps on the trail and starts walking into the woods and found out, I think in the fourth mile, he realized that, like, 3 miles back, he had made a mistake and taken the wrong branch. So he had to turn around and hike 3 miles back just to get where he was started from. And so, again, he began to learn lessons from, you know, the little bitty mistakes he was making. But it was an amazing experience. He, you know, he hiked during the wintertime. He hiked in the spring break. And then the day after prom, we put him on an airplane, flew him down to Georgia, which is the beginning of the trail. And he hiked and so all total, he was on the trail for 89 days by himself.
How did the initial 2 or 3 or 4 of him must have scared you to death? I mean, I would be scared.
I was terrified.
How did you hide that from him? Well, did you hide it from him?
Oh, I didn't hide it. I took it out on my husband, I think. because his very first trip, we decided to start in southern Vermont because we live in Rhode Island. And so we drove my son to southern Vermont. We left him off in a parking lot, and he began to hike south. And the plan was we would stay at a bed and breakfast over Columbus Day weekend in Vermont, and then we would pick him up, you know, wherever the agreed-upon place for us to pick him up, which by then I think it was he would hike into Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. And hello?
I'm here.
Oh, okay. And then we took him back the next vacation where he left off in Massachusetts and hiked a little bit more south. And so by the time we put him on the airplane to go to Georgia, he had hiked the section from southern Vermont all the way down to the New Jersey-Delaware water gap. And so then when he went down to Georgia, he hiked from Georgia up to the Delaware water gap. We picked him up, brought him back to that parking lot in Vermont, and then he hiked the remaining miles up to Vermont, up to Maine, where the trail ends.
Now, Rudy, I know that I've heard you say that this hike, you know, this odyssey that your son embarked on led to you writing your book, Take Heart. How did that come about?
One of the things, when I had owned the travel agency, around the time my husband was diagnosed with cancer. And in the middle of his treatment, his company decides to promote him to Rhode Island. At the point when he was diagnosed, we were living in the South. And so we asked the doctors, what do we do? And the doctor said, oh, you got to get on with your life. So we accepted the promotion to Rhode Island, but immediately my husband's cancer came back, and it came back with a vengeance. So I was here for 3 months, and he passed away with cancer. And one of the things that he ended up giving me a bicycle for my birthday right before he passed away. And I remember thinking, well, gee, that's a wonderful gift. When did I ever say I wanted to ride a bicycle? But the year after he passed away, I had this brand new bicycle in my garage, and I found a bicycle path that runs along the coastline in Rhode Island. And so pretty much just as my therapy, my excuse to get out of the house as a young widow, I would ride this bicycle. And on the bicycle path, I met this gentleman that worked for our local newspaper. And I told him I had owned a travel agency. I told him all the traveling I had done. And he said, well, why don't you write about it and write about moving to Rhode Island? And he had no idea I was widowed. So I wrote an article about moving to Rhode Island and losing my husband to cancer 3 months later. And when that went in the newspaper, the response was amazing. And so a woman called me up, and she said, would you speak to my women's group? And I said, no way. I said, you're crazy. I said, I'm not a speaker. And she said, well, if you change your mind, I'm going to insist that you take my number. And about 6 months later, I called her up, and I said, look, I'll be terrible. And actually, I was. I fulfilled my promise. But in the audience that day, there was a brand new widow, and she had just lost her husband. And when I shared my story, she came up at the end with tears streaming down her eyes, saying, I now know someday, somehow, I'm going to be okay. And it opened that door of even being able to entertain the possibility of a life after the death of, you know, of her precious husband. And so then at that point, I began to write, or I began to speak, like, full time. I realized the impact. So I had to learn what it meant to be a speaker. I had to learn the business of speaking. I had to learn the craft of speaking. I hired a coach. And then when my son began to hike the Appalachian Trail, people were saying, well, keep us updated. You know, let us know what's going on.
Right.
And I thought, well, I don't really have the time to write everybody. So what I did was I wrote it was like an email update. It was really a blog, but it was pre-blog days. And so I wrote this email. I mailed it to everybody. And all of a sudden, I started getting all these emails from people saying, I want more. I heard about this through my cousin's brother's neighbor.
Sure.
I want more. And it eventually spread all over the United States. I had some people in Europe. I had some people in Australia that were all reading this blog on my son's journey. And after my son completed his hike, and I realized the courage it took him to do that, And courage on my part to give him permission to do it.
Oh,
then I realized,
God, yes.
I have had a book hanging over my head. Now I have to find the courage to write that book. And so I wrote this book. And it turned out it was a book of humorous essays. It was really fun. I was one time contacted by a production company in London, and they said, we understand you have funny stories. And I said, yeah. And they said, well, we want to reenact some of them. Was a TV pilot called Ultimate Blunders. So I sent them the book, and I highlighted the areas that they might be interested in. And they actually sent a crew to the United States to reenact some of the things that are in my book. And it was so funny. It turned out the TV pilot was never accepted, so it didn't get aired, but it was just so much fun. And so that's really how I got launched into writing this book. And it was because I identified, you know, what was life-changing in my life,
right.
And what did I need to embrace to make a difference in somebody else's life?
And see, I think there you just hit on everything that I wanted to pull out of you today. How do you identify these things, and what do you do? You know, that's exactly what I think so many people need to know now and be aware of. You can't, it's a very poor, you can do this, but it's a very poor idea to just get out of bed, go do the same thing you did yesterday, and go to bed without gaining any insight or going deep and trying to figure out why you're here, what you're going to do, and how what your best value is. It's kind of like that real estate term, what's the best and highest use? I look at myself in the same way, what is my best and highest use? And I think that more and more people are becoming aware that, you know, maybe that's something that we should do daily. What is our best and highest use? Why are we here? Now, one thing that I know, you tend to be just a little bit disaster prone.
Yeah.
Just a little bit. I would love for you to share some of those stories.
Well, as a young wife, my husband's promotions were taking him all over the country, and he was just, you know, jumping, you know, getting higher and higher in the corporate world. And so I was actually quite full of myself being the corporate wife. And one time he was having this event in our hometown, and it was to bring in all the people from his region, the best producers in his region, and he was going to wine and dine them and entertain them for a weekend in our city, which was a wonderful city to live in. And he goes ahead to set things up in the resort community, and I said, well, I'll get there later, and I go to the reception. I said, I need the key to Bill Wilson's room, and they hand it to me. And again, I'm the, you know, boss's wife. I'm all full of myself, and I walk into the hotel room, and it was a beautiful hotel room, but it was typical layout, you know, where your bathroom was off to the left, and there was a long hallway, and it opened up into a magnificent bedroom. So I walk into the room, and the bathroom door is wide open. There's billows of steam coming out from the shower, and I'm walking down this hall, and there's a pair of mustard-colored shoes on the floor, and I'm thinking, when did Bill buy mustard-colored shoes? And I'm like, well, he does his own shopping. I don't have to worry about that. So then I go in the bedroom. I put my suitcase on the bed, and I unzip it and start, you know, putting my things in the bureau and, you know, unpacking. And I look over on the bed, and the other suitcase is open, and it's silk-lined. And I'm like, when did Bill get a silk-lined suitcase? And all of a sudden I'm like, oh, no. So I realized this is not two good things. Things are not good. And so I grabbed everything out of the bureau. I threw it in the suitcase. I zipped it up. I go running down the hallway. And just as I got down to the end of the hallway, the man exits the shower, and he's naked as a jaybird. I was like, oh, my God.
I knew that was
I was airborne, screaming at the top of my lungs. I get down to the hotel, I'm shaking by this time, and I said, there's a naked man in that room, and it's not my husband. Of course, the clerks, they thought it was so funny. So then that night, my husband had set it up where it was sort of like a, almost like a reception line. He was online introducing people, getting people to know each other, and he's standing online. I'm next to him, and he has his arm around me. And his top producer from the state of Kansas walks up, and my husband says to him, he goes, you wouldn't believe what happened to my wife this afternoon. And the guy smiles, and he goes, oh, yes, I would. And as I'm standing on this line, my eyes drop down to the floor, and the man's wearing mustard-colored shoes. So I got to see his top producer from Kansas.
Naked.
In all his natural beauty. And that kind of stuff, it happens to me all the time.
Why do you suppose that is?
I don't know. I don't know. One time I had, it's just typical. Last year I went to the grocery store, and I'm, you know, I love eating natural. I love eating, you know, fresh fruits and vegetables. And so it was about this time last year, and I thought, I'm going to pick the perfect watermelon. So I'm at my grocery store, and I'm like looking at them. I'm checking them out. Okay, which one's big? Which one has the right coloring? So I grabbed this one watermelon out of this pyramid of watermelons, this big display, and all of a sudden I realized I had created a watermelon avalanche. And watermelons, these round ball watermelons, started rolling down this avalanche, and they're crashing on the floor. And I'm like, oh, what am I going to do? So I decided to stop this in its tracks, and I jumped up and over the avalanche, up and over the display. But now I realize, with my arms spread, my legs spread, I'm like, if I move one muscle, we're going to lose another one. And there's this poor high school kid who's just working a job, who's like, lady, you know. And it was so funny, the people's reactions, because the people around me, it tells you about personalities. The one woman came up to me and she goes, oh my goodness, something like that happened to me. And she starts telling me this story about something that happened to her. And I'm like, I really don't care right now. And then another lady, she puts her head down and another lady marches off, and you know, and other people are pretending to, you know, that I'm not laying there across this watermelon display. It's like, that's life.
And those do make, I mean, they make terrific stories. You might as well write about them.
Yeah,
I mean, really, you just might as well.
I mean, one time, even as a heart patient, you know, we are dealt these tough blows in life, and I've had two open heart surgeries. And one time, prior to my second open heart surgery, I was admitted to the hospital. I had a heart infection, and they put me in a room, and it was three other patients. I mean, having a room with four patients in one room is unheard of. Mm-hmm. But I find the one hospital and the one floor and the one room that has an open bed, and I got three roommates. Now, one lady, the lady across from me, is in a coma. I really liked her. And the lady next to me, she had some form of dementia that she thought I was her daughter, and she wanted to kill me. She literally wanted to kill me. And so they finally eventually had to tie her down, you know, put things, because she was after me. And then there was another lady who was critically ill, and she would strip herself naked. And the nurses said, well, just buzz us when she gets down to nothing. And I'm like, I got a heart infection here. You know, I got better things to, you know, rather than to buzz you every time.
Concentrating.
It was crazy.
I'm concentrating on breathing here.
Exactly. Wow. And so it's like, you know, you could deal with the situation. So I decided, my approach was to escape. I took my little IV pole, and I decided I'm leaving. I might be in pajamas, I might be attached to an IV pole, but I'm leaving. I've had enough. But they caught me before I got out the front door. And but after they caught me, they gave me a private room, so it was wonderful. But the thing is, you know, we do go through these challenges, and so many times we have to ask ourselves, do I give myself permission to be open to the humor, or am I going to focus on the anger and the, you know, the resentment and all the tough stuff? You know, because I'm not saying that I've had the toughest life, but I've dealt with a lot of, you know, significant challenges, and there are times where humor just doesn't work. It's not appropriate.
Right.
But I think if we give ourselves permission to at least be open to the humor, it can be the kind of thing that we can turn around and walk through these tough times and come away feeling, you know, as if well, at least we're whole, you know?
Right. Listen, I cannot agree with you more. I mean, there are times when you have to just kind of sit down, put your head between your knees and gulp. I mean, you have to just kind of gulp back tears or let yourself cry.
Absolutely, let yourself cry.
I'm not a crier. I was trained as a very young child not to cry, and I've never really learned how.
Wow.
So I've always deflected all of the, it's an odd story, but we were just taught as children, you do not cry. So I don't. I simply do not. That's probably not good for my health. So I tend to deflect a lot of things with humor, and I can get fairly sardonic. But through life, I have trained myself to find the most exquisite humor in some of the ickiest situations, because everything has a funny side, whether you recognize it or not. And, you know, sometimes, I mean, I'll catch myself laughing a little bit hysterically, but at least I'm not crying.
Right.
But you're right. I mean, you have to look for the humor, and you have to, even if you're laughing at your own self, which often is the best thing to do.
Self-directed humor.
Because if you take yourself too seriously, you're not a fun girl. You're just not. So, I mean, I love your story. But, you know, one of the things, and we've got about 60 seconds here, but I really just wanted people to listen to you and find that you can do what you want to do. You really can. You can make the life that you need for yourself. You just need to do it. And I know that's an oversimplistic view of what you just said, but who's in charge of us? We are.
Right.
So there you go.
Well, I think, again, baby steps is really the way you need to go. Create your foundation and then move forward. Yeah. And ask yourself, you know, what's important to me? What you know gives me joy.
And look for the humor in life.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, even if you are flat broke and you've got $1.59 in the bank, you still have something you can smile at or laugh about.
Right. Right.
I mean, that's one thing that I have learned through life, and you clearly have too, is that every day is different from the day before. And you cannot predict what the day tomorrow is going to. You can't predict what's going to happen in an hour. So you might as well just enjoy what you're doing right here, right now.
Right.
And make those solid decisions. So, Rudy, thank you so much for being with me here today. I really enjoyed it. I got to giggle and laugh, and that's not something I get to do during my interviews. Normally they're a lot more serious. But this interview was so terrific because even though it's a very serious subject, we had a great deal of fun with it.
Right.
I enjoyed it, and I know our audience enjoyed it just as much as I did. And the show, by the way, will be, for those who are you listening now, will be available for download in about an hour, and it will be on iTunes later on today. So this is Denise Griffiths and Rudy Wilson-Galdonik, and we are wishing you a great weekend. Thank you, Rudy.
Thank you. Thank you.
And bye.
Bye-bye.